This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 116 was recorded on May 3rd, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Well-known author and macro strategist Russell Napier joins me as this week's featured interview guest. We'll discuss why Russell thinks that the apparent signs of oncoming inflation are likely a false alarm that will be short-lived, and why the most important risk to watch for is the development of another credit crisis. We'll discuss the U.S. dollar's slow-motion loss of hegemony over the world economy and its implications, Chinese credit expansion, and much more. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will take a deep dive into the U.S. dollar's price action relative to various different currencies, both those inside and outside the dollar index basket. You might be surprised by a trend we've discovered in the dollar crosses with EM currencies.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, when I was looking at the S&P 500 on the first response of the Fed minutes, it looked like it was going to bull break out, and that lasted exactly like 30 minutes. And then the S&P 500 just been selling since then. We even temporarily were teasing below the 2600. Are we still looking for this to break badly on the downside, or is this going to put in a short-term bottom here?
Well, I'm still looking for another leg down to the mid-2400s before this correction is over. Whether it's a correction or the beginning of a full-on bear market will probably depend on the Treasury yield, as we've discussed, but we are pulling back away from those highs that we saw last week. I don't think that this week's tape action has been terribly conclusive. We did see that breakdown below the 200-day moving average. We're retracing, defending today back up to 2623 or so, as we're just a few minutes before the close on Thursday afternoon. So I think that we still do have another leg lower. The question is, what happens after that?
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index, because obviously we've had some huge momentum to the upside. A little bit of a pause today. We're trading around that 92.45 level. Do you think that this dollar move's got more legs?
I think it does. You know, we're still seeing that move accelerating. A little pause is certainly to be expected with the big run that we've had higher. We closed above the 200-day moving average. That's definitely a bullish sign. Maybe we're coming back down and testing it now. I think still this chart to me looks very bullish, at least in the short to intermediate term. Now, I'm still very bearish on the U.S. dollar in the very long term, but it looks to me like this does have some legs. I took the opportunity, Patrick, to reach out to our friend Juliet to Clerk. And, you know, she has gotten her clients out of the way of this dollar rally. She closed her short positions, but she feels this is a counter trend rally, and she thinks that it's set to resume in a secular downtrend on the dollar. You'll have to stay tuned later this month to find out her reasons for thinking that.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, which is still holding around the 68.43 level right now near the close. Well, let's start off with the inventories. What happened this week?
Well, Patrick, last week I said that we'd had a fairly bearish inventory report, but the market just shrugged it off because of geopolitical risk and moved higher anyway. A little bit of a repeat this week, except this time it was a really, really, really bearish inventory report. Crude oil, 6.2 million barrel build on inventories, three times bigger than analyst expectations. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 416,000 barrels. Gasoline, building 1.1 million barrels. The holdout was distillates, drawing down 3.9 million barrels. Even more bearish, production up another 33,000 barrels per day to a new record of 10.619 million barrels per day of domestic production. Exports, again, over 2 million barrels. That works out to 15 million barrels on the week that would have been added to inventory if they were not exported. And the dollar breakout, which should be oil bearish, so many different factors coming together. There was, of course, a spike down in crude oil prices as a result of this very, very bearish inventory report. Last week, it lasted about 20 minutes. This time, it was about 10 to 15 minutes, and we were off to the races again, moving even even higher. So I think it's pretty darn clear that until May 12th, this market is all about Iran. And what is Donald Trump going to do? Is there going to be a reimposition of Iranian sanctions, which, of course, the mechanism there is Donald Trump has until the 12th of May, which is a Saturday, to make the decision whether or not to renew the waiver of sanctions. So if he takes no action and does not renew the waiver, then the sanctions go back into effect. And I think the market has pretty much priced in that outcome. Of course, on the announcement, there's likely to be another spike higher in price. No surprise there. But I think for the most part, we've already priced in that outcome of Iranian sanctions being reimposed. The big question, and what I think the market is really starting to price in a lot of risk around, is what more could happen than just reimposing the sanctions? Is there going to be a more aggressive action? Of course, on Monday, we had Mr. Netanyahu's presentation, really not presenting any new evidence, but making a very outspoken and strong argument that Israel certainly would appreciate the United States taking a tougher stance on Iran. With John Bolton in the White House, I think that it's very likely that there's going to be at least a reimposition of sanctions on Iran, if not more than that. So all of these things come together, and they're putting a lot of tension on the market to the point where I don't think anybody is even paying attention to inventory. As I say, the very, very bearish inventory number only pushed the price down for about 15 minutes this week. Now, there is a very big risk, but it is a very unlikely risk. In the extremely unlikely case that the European leaders that are meeting with Trump next week are somehow successful in persuading him to go ahead and renew the waiver on Iranian sanctions, that would cause a dramatic sell-off because that is not priced into the market. Everybody is assuming that the Iranian sanctions are going to be reimposed. So that is a possibility, but definitely the outlier case. I won't be surprised, though, if what we see is a lot more volatility into next week, and things probably won't actually settle until we find out what happens after May 12th.
All right, Eric, let's move on to gold. And gold, obviously, getting a little bit of a reaction, still holding above the 1300 level. And as the dollar kind of seems to have taken a little bit of a break, gold has popped a little bit. But so far, its correlation to the dollar seems to be the most dominant. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yeah, I think it's all about the dollar, with the caveat that if we go just to reimposition of sanctions on Iran, I don't think that is particularly bullish for gold. But on the other hand, if we were to see some kind of military action or, you know, something bigger than sanctions going on, further geopolitical escalation, that could be very bullish for gold. In absence of that happening, though, I think that if the dollar continues to move higher, gold continues to move lower. We traded below that key support level of 1308, but only very briefly. No breakdown so far. Tested that level and rejected it. I think that the Fed not hiking rates helped gold, at least temporarily, and it remains to be seen. So, you know, the salvation for gold is going to be if Juliet de Klerk is proven right and the dollar rally doesn't have much further to go and ends up fizzling out and reversing, that's bullish for gold. If there's a geopolitical escalation, that's bullish for gold. But if the dollar continues to rally, I think gold is going to face a pretty serious headwind.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields. As I'm looking right here, we're coming off that 305 level in the last week or so. We've given back about 10 points, trading around the 294 level right now. What's your thinking on interest rates? Is that 305 going to be the overhead resistance here?
Well, Patrick, exactly as I predicted last week, what we saw was everybody freaking out as we went over 3%, but the real number was 305. And the way resistance levels work, the reason they're called resistance levels, is because you tend to move up to them, test them, and move away from them. Now, it doesn't mean we're not going to break through it, but this was the first test of that very key level at 305. We got up and almost tested it. I can't remember if the high print was 303 or 304. It was pretty darn close. And we've now pulled back more than 10 basis points. I think that it is likely that eventually we do break out above 3.05 and we move to higher yields and lower bond prices. The thing is, this is a perfect setup for a short squeeze. We have never, ever in history had bond speculators more short than they are right now, as indicated by the commitment of traders reports. So, you know, we're going to eventually break out, but this is where people tend to get set up. They wait until you're almost at the breakout level. They think it's coming. They jump the gun, and it ends up just setting the market up for a short squeeze. Maybe we're seeing the beginning of that. We thought that was happening once before, and the squeeze never really materialized. We moved about 10 or 15 basis points and then just moved to a new higher high. I think that we've got room for that squeeze to happen. I'm not going to bet on it happening. But as far as shorting bonds, I wouldn't do that until we've seen a clear and decisive breakout past 305. Couple of daily candles completely past that 305 line in the sand. That's where I get confident that there's actually been a breakout. At this point, it's a very key level. There could be several tests of resistance before we eventually break through it. And who knows if we get a short squeeze in the meantime.
Well, thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, renowned author and macro strategist Russell Napier is this week's featured interview guest. Eric's interview with Russell Napier is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is macroeconomic strategist Russell Napier, also author of Anatomy of the Bear, one of the most respected books on bear markets and bear market bottoms. Russell, thanks so much for joining us in the program. You recently penned an excellent article emphasizing the case for deflation rather than inflation in the United States based on central bank policy. One of the things you emphasized in that article back at the time it was written, everybody and his brother was saying, okay, the U.S. dollar is about to crash. You said, no, opposite, U.S. dollar is bottoming and about to strengthen. And a lot of people thought you were crazy. Needless to say, the tape action has proven you right. At least so far, we're seeing very strong positive action in the U.S. dollar. So please give our listeners a quick overview of your argument favoring deflation and why you have such a bullish view on the U.S. dollar at this particular juncture in time.
Sure, happy to do so. And I would just, there's many issues I could raise for the US dollar, but let me just pick on two, which is the level of real rates of interest in the United States of America and the growing prospects of a credit event or a default outside the United States of America. Both of these, I think, are ingredients for a strong dollar and also an ingredient for lower global inflation, and it may be globally feeding back into the United States of America. The interest rates, I know most people, or just about everybody, believes that U.S. rates are rising to reflect more inflation. And of course, that could be correct. I would point out that something has happened with that U.S. Treasury market that hasn't happened in my entire investment career, which is now 30 years old. And that is that as we speak today, central bankers are net sellers of treasuries. We know what the Federal Reserve plans to sell this year, this calendar year, $228 billion. We know what the rise in global foreign reserves are. About 64% of that will flow into United States assets. Slightly less of that will flow into treasuries. But it isn't $228. At the current rate at which world foreign reserves are accumulating, we are not going to see foreign central bankers offsetting the sales from the Fed. So that's a net sell. We don't know what that net sale will be, but it's a net sell from central bankers at a time when the Congressional Budget Office forecasts a $1 trillion, roughly $1 trillion fiscal deficit. So this is the first time in my investment career that savers will have to fund the whole lot. And it's perfectly normal that real rates of interest have to go higher to attract those savings. $1 trillion is still a large amount of money. It can come from anywhere in the world. It can come from outside of the United States. It can come from inside the United States. But it's a liquidation of other assets or a rising savings rate, which is necessary to fund this. Either of these things are positive for the dollar. What we can't know for sure is how much of the capital to fund the U.S. Treasury will actually come from offshore. But history suggests that huge amounts of money can be attracted into the U.S. dollar at reasonable rates of interest. I think we'll come on to discuss whether this is a reasonable rate of interest or not. But the fact that the dollar started to rise in the last few weeks is perhaps confirming that foreigners believe that this is an attractive rate of interest. And it is obviously relative to what else is available in the so-called risk-free assets that are government bonds compared to Japan, compared to Northern Europe, and therefore that is attracting capital. That will continue for quite some time. it will clearly have to bring up, to some extent, European yields with it that can't bring up Japanese yields. So I think it will continue for some time, and that's the first thing that underpins the United States dollar. Very briefly, because I suspect we'll come back to it, are these credit events that are breaking out in various places in the world. Remember, the United States dollar is heavily borrowed across the planet, and also heavily borrowed by people who don't actually generate U.S. dollar revenue. The rise in the dollar, the rise in interest rates, the rise in the spread of cost of borrowing dollars in Europe is causing some distress. My particular bugbear on this is Turkey, where I think the whole country is basically getting to the edge of defaulting on its debts. It's a $432 billion credit risk, Turkey, on the global financial system. I think it's important. And history shows one thing and one thing clearly. If you get into a situation of a credit event, particularly if it pertains to people who've borrowed dollars and don't actually have them or generate them, then you get a strong dollar. We get an unwinding of that situation. And I think if we were very unlucky, it could spread beyond Turkey into other emerging markets. So that would be the two kind of building blocks for saying why the dollar is probably going up and not down.
Russell, in your article, which we have a link to in our Research Roundup email for our listeners' convenience who'd like to read it, you make an excellent argument for why the environment in the United States really favors deflation, not inflation. Yet a lot of people are observing a lot of signs that sure look like inflation, whether it be oil and copper prices and commodities generally catching a bid, very strong social pressure for increasing minimum wages, a number of other things that we're seeing, a number of other data points look like inflation is making a comeback. What do you think is going on, considering, as you've argued so well, it really doesn't make sense to expect monetary inflation in this environment?
Yeah, well, I think I'd focus on the fact we have had this before. We have had a combination of these things before, which were absolutely pointing to higher inflation. And that was the first half of 2008. With the benefit of hindsight, we know that the U.S. economy peaked in December 2007, was actually contracting through both the quarters, at which commodity prices in particular were very strong. The European Central Bank actually raised interest rates in that period, believing that these commodity prices would feed through to inflation. And of course, I'm not suggesting the surprise can be as bad this time, but the surprise that came along that we didn't really get is that these credit events in America that were coming out of the residential property market were big enough not just to slow U.S. growth, but actually, through a credit crisis, slow global growth. So I would first point out that it's not new to see inflation and commodity prices rising, even as we are heading sort of about to head in the other direction. The specific issues I would raise in relation to why inflation in the United States can come down, and this may not be necessarily to do with lower economic growth, but why it should come down is first money supply growth. Now, I know that not everybody believes that money supply growth is an important thing. I think it is important. You know, money supply growth, with velocity fairly steady to actually falling, is down at 4% M2 growth. I've looked at all the quarters since World War II. In only 16% of quarters has the growth in American M2 been as low or lower than that. I recently came across a really interesting article written by our presentation by Milton Friedman on a Friday in October 1987. Where he remarked upon the slowdown in M2 growth, not dissimilar to the slowdown we've seen since the third quarter of 2016, quite similar to what we're now seeing, saying this slowdown in M2 growth means we're going to have a recession in 1988. Now, he was wrong. There was no recession in 1988, but the stock market did fall 22% the Monday after he made his comment. So I just look at the level of M2 growth and I say, can this be reconciled with the consensus? Because the consensus view is higher real growth, higher inflation, and higher asset prices. And I find it difficult to reconcile the growth in money with that. So I could be wrong that money is negative for inflation. Maybe inflation goes up and it's real growth that takes the pain. Maybe it's inflation goes up and it's the stock market that takes the pain. But on the whole, it's hard to reconcile that number with rising growth and rising inflation. And if any, you know, if real growth takes the pain or the asset market takes the pain, I think quite quickly inflation expectations would change anyway, because we would assume there will be some impact on inflation from certainly from lower economic growth and perhaps a negative wealth effect from sharply lower asset prices. So money supply growth. And finally, the strong U.S. dollar, which I talked about briefly earlier, clearly that tends to import deflation into America. It has done that remarkably well in the past, I think particularly of the late 1990s, against the background of a a crisis elsewhere in the world, the dollar was going higher and import prices were falling. And then finally, also, as I mentioned earlier, a credit crunch. But the easiest way to believe in lower inflation, at least, if not deflation, is the credit event that slows global growth. And as I'm someone who believes in a credit event that slows global growth, particularly emerging market growth, then whatever you think is being generated internally in terms of inflation in the United States, throwing a spanner in the works of emerging market growth, I think, would quite quickly have inflation expectations and ultimately inflation itself coming down, led by commodity prices, given the role of emerging market growth in buoying commodity prices.
Well, your reference to 2008 obviously begs the question as to what may be in store both for equity markets and is there a risk of another credit crisis? I don't know if we want to take those together or separately. We can either start with equity markets or maybe the two are interrelated. What do you see in terms of equity market? Some people are saying, you know, this is the beginning of a really big bear market. It's not just a correction. It's a really big deal. You're the man who wrote the book on bear markets. So do you see that as a serious risk? And if it's related, we can cover the credit as part of that, or we can come back to credit crisis if that fits better.
Yeah, well, I think let's start with the credit crisis, actually, because if we look, we have looked at the four great bottoms. So there's been lots of bottoms and lots of opportunities to buy equities. But the four great bottoms are, by definition, associated with the most distress. And that distress, probably not in 1921, but otherwise is associated with some degree of credit distress. So if it is going to be a big one, we have to see that credit distress. Now, I would argue that we're in a world where that is likely. The simple metric to say that it's likely is the total debt to GDP ratio of the world is significantly above its 2007 level, and we had an economic recession then, which, you know, threatened to turn into a depression because of levels of gearing. It's actually higher. Even if we take out government debt and say government debt's not risky, private sector debt, non-financial sector debt, is actually also at a new all-time high. So if there was a fragility in the system associated with the way we ran the financial system in 2007, I think it's around today. Looking at America, particularly for banks, it wouldn't seem to be particularly worrisome directly for the United States of America's banking system. They are much better capitalized. The risk models they use are much more reasonable, the leverage models. There are so many things that have happened to make that U.S. banking system look much, much more stable and much more capable of coping with credit problems than it was before. But as I stressed in the opening statement, I think the credit issues really fall outside the United States. So it's not clear to me that the banking systems outside of the United States of America have been significantly improved and recapitalized. Particularly in Europe, the lack of capital, I think, is noticeable. The fact that they're still using their own risk models also is somewhat worrying. And, of course, in the emerging markets, we've seen an unparalleled growth in debt to GDP. And some recent work by the BIS suggests that the most worrying the early warning indicator for a credit crisis is really the pace of growth in credit to GDP relative to trend. And if we pick all the problem children out of the world based on the BIS numbers, the vast majority of them are emerging markets. So the credit issue, I don't think, will be particularly bad for the United States of America, but could be bad very much elsewhere. I would point to the fact that that should lead to a particularly strong dollar, if that is the correct call, that efforts to buoy up the banking systems elsewhere outside of America are usually sort of easier monetary policy, whereas America may continue to go very much on its own path with a very strong United States dollar. So this could be a very major issue with interest rates so low. It would definitely have a feedback effect on the United States of America and its equity market, particularly given the need to fund the United States Treasury. But I think most of the pain of this would actually fall outside the U.S. So I haven't given you a very clear answer on that. I'd be surprised if this was necessarily the big one for the United States. We'll have to sit and watch that. But for some other markets, particularly the European markets, this could really be very dangerous indeed. And I should just add again about Turkey. If Turkey goes down, and I think it will do that by devaluing, imposing exchange controls, the burden of that falls on the European banks. But there's a huge, potentially huge social burden as well, in that Turkey is looking after 3 million refugees for the European Union. It's being paid by the European Union to do so. And if, for whatever reason, the president of Turkey decided to release those refugees, then Europe would face an economic crisis and a social crisis simultaneously. And I'd be therefore much more concerned about the outlook for European equities than American equities.
There's the old expression that when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold, because there is just so much dominance that the U.S. dollar plays in the rest of the financial system. It seems to me that their credit risk, if you look at China's credit growth since 2009, I mean, it's just off the charts in terms of crazy, crazy credit growth. In terms of contagion risk, if China not only sneezes but gets outright credit pneumonia, is the contagion risk there to the rest of the world in terms of bringing on a global crisis, or do you think it would be contained in China and, say, in surrounding Asian economies?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question, because we've always said that about America, haven't we? And to some extent, it's been true, but we don't live in this kind of unipolar world anymore. We now have this huge second largest economy in the world, and it has been important. It's been crucially important for countries such as Australia and Canada in terms of resources, and so on, you know, and also for the rest of Asia. So the key contamination from China to the rest of the world is the exchange rate. It's not necessarily lower growth in China. It's not necessarily a credit event in China. It's if China had to solve those problems via a lower exchange rate, and that's the transmission mechanism. But when America sneezes, the world catches a cold. It's true. I would also say when the dollar rises, the world catches a cold, because so many of the emerging markets have linked to the dollar, and therefore just a rising dollar, even against the background of a reasonably buoyant U.S. economy, can cause havoc in emerging markets. I would go back to the late 1990s again, 1997, 1998. The U.S. economy was doing fine, but the dollar was going up, and many, many emerging market economies went bankrupt. They had too much debt, the dollar went up, liquidity tightened, and it was all over. Now, China didn't, because China was running a very large and robust current account surplus that had only recently devalued itself. It was highly competitive. That's not where China is today. It runs a much, much smaller current account surplus. As we know, the capital account is theoretically closed, but in practice leaks pretty badly, and there is a significant will amongst the people of China to get their money out of China. So the strong dollar, if it continues and if it comes to pass, really could force China into a corner. That, combined with the trade tariff policies of the president, may be leading us to a more flexible exchange rate, or at least what would be billed as a more flexible exchange rate, but for all intents and purposes is likely to be a weaker Chinese exchange rate. So I was just going to read you the list of those emerging market economies where the debt-to-GDP ratio has been growing so strongly that actually the BIS suggests there is a risk of a systemic banking crisis, because China is top of the list. You're absolutely right to point to China. But anyway, here is the list of countries where the current rate of growth of debt to GDP suggests a credit crisis. China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Canada, Switzerland, Mexico, Norway, Turkey, Czech Republic, Malaysia, Chile, Indonesia, Thailand, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, and they've just added France to the amber list for a country that should be warned about. So the focus is, of course, on China. It is a quasi-command economy. They tend to keep cycles going for longer than any of us can believe. But the spread, and there is about three developed world economies in that list as well, the spread of economies where debt to GDP has been growing very, very rapidly is really very wide indeed, and well beyond China.
It seems like your focus on where the risks lie is primarily in credit crises. And I can't help but think, boy, where we are at this moment in history, we're getting precipitously close to some key technical levels in interest rates and bond yields. Specifically, the 30-year U.S. Treasury has not seen a monthly close above its 100-month moving average since the early 1980s. Now, that level now is about 3.25%, or about 12 basis points above the current yield as we're speaking this week. So maybe it's a little bit early to deliver a decisive call that a reversal into a secular bond bear market has begun, but it seems like we could certainly make the argument that we're getting close, or that there's a risk of that if it's not actually confirmed. So I guess it strikes me that the risk of credit crisis has to be worse if you're in a secular environment where interest rates, you know, money's getting more expensive, not less expensive, as was the case in the last credit crisis. How does that play out? And from a monetary history standpoint, what do you think the significance and consequences are of such a long-term trend reversal in yields coming at a time when it seems like the economy, in your description, is not able to tolerate much higher yields, if I've understood you correctly?
Yeah. So I think there's definitely a role already being played by higher U.S. rates. And if the dollar goes higher as well, it's definitely playing a role in creating vulnerabilities. We've seen a couple of large Chinese companies unable to pay their U.S. dollar credit. As I mentioned, there's a lot of Turkish companies that really can't pay it. And that has already something to do with the rise in U.S. yields. I mean, I know they've gone from incredibly low levels to low levels, but it's enough at the margin when global debt to GDP is to shine the light on particularly vulnerable economies and particularly vulnerable companies. It's not my view that we've begun a new secular bear market for the reasons I've mentioned. Basically, I'm looking at that going the other way. However, if it does, I did write a report back in 2009, trying to advise investors as to how long they should hold into the bull market, having written a pretty bullish piece at the beginning of 2009. And I came to this conclusion that it wasn't bond yields per se, rising bond yields per se, if we did get growth and inflation, that would call the end to the U.S. equity bull market. What would call an end to it was actually inflation. Inflation was a better gauge. I know there should be a link between inflation and bonds, and I looked at that. But I did come up with a magic number. So any magic number is clearly dangerous, but the magic number was 4% inflation. In other words, if bond yields are rising in the United States of America, it reflects higher growth and higher inflation. And that's not necessarily in the early stages bad for U.S. equities. However, history has shown that about 4% inflation, the Fed had tended to get quite aggressive, tended to not to acquiesce so much to what was going on, get aggressive. And that seemed to be when equities reacted negatively. Why wouldn't they? If nominal rates or short-term rates are going up, the risk-free rate is going up to attack growth. In terms of a discounting model, higher discount rate and a lower growth rate are clearly bad for net present value. But the crucial thing was that was when inflation was closer to 4, and we've got quite a ways to go on that. So all I would add, let's say I'm wrong on U.S. rates and these yields continue to rise. I think that's particularly bearish for those outside of America who borrow dollars, the people we've already focused on. I think United States growth may be good. United States inflation may be rising. I wouldn't specifically see any particularly bad credit issues in America. I don't see being anything like we've seen in the past. But outside of America, I think there'd be an awful lot of pain going on as interest rates go higher and higher and higher, remembering that roughly the European banks, or I should say non-US global banks, have got a loan book in dollars of about $4.5 trillion. That's a big loan book for people who don't really take US dollar deposits. And the implications of higher US rates and a higher dollar mean that the pain may not be so America-specific, but it could be very emerging market-specific.
More and more people have been suggesting that the U.S. dollar is slowly losing its reserve currency status. You and I discussed the possibility off the air of doing an interview comparing what happened when the pound sterling lost its reserve currency status and, you know, what we might expect from that. But you observed that the circumstances are just so different today from the situation that existed back then that a direct comparison is probably not relevant. So why don't we talk about this whole idea of U.S. dollar losing reserve currency status in terms of the actual present conditions. And I guess the first question that comes to my mind is, historically, reserve currency has referred to the currency that's used for international trade settlement as well as for central bank reserves. And back in the days when these concepts were first invented, it wasn't possible to do Forex transactions at the click of a mouse in a few milliseconds. So in an environment where you can easily transact globally in any currency that you want, do we still need a reserve currency per se? And what are the criteria that are important for a currency to have? And it seems to me like maybe the definition of what a reserve currency is changing as a result of the times.
Yeah, so in preparation for that, I went away and did some studying, because like everybody else, I think I know what the decline of sterling was all about. But then when you begin to read it, you realize that you don't really get it, sterling being the last reserve currency. So there's an excellent book on this by Catherine Schenck. I spend all day going through the differences, but let's pick a key one. Capital controls. During most of the decline of sterling, which we'll take from the end of World War II, let's say, to the involvement of the IMF in the mid-1970s with the United Kingdom economy, the United Kingdom operated under capital controls. So the state system, the central bankers may have been able to take money out, and even that was pretty difficult and needed some permissions, but the private sector didn't. So we live in an entirely different world today, where at least today, in most countries, private sector capital moves freely. So that one reason alone, I think it's difficult to draw conclusions. But there are actually many, many others in terms of who were the owners of British government debt at the end of the Second World War. And they were mostly ex-colonies, part of the empire, becoming part of the Commonwealth. And you can see the ties and the links there, which made it just very different from the much more commercial relationships that operate between the United States and the people who own its reserves. So I think you hit on a really important point there. It's possible to have a reserve currency that nobody accumulates. If we lived in a world of entirely flexible exchange rates, nobody would be accumulating a reserve currency. Nobody would be liquidating a reserve currency, but nobody would be accumulating it. The reason we've had such a huge boom in the total amount of reserves, total amount of treasuries owned by foreign central bankers, is they chose to intervene in their exchange rates. Now, obviously they still are, but nowhere near to the forced intervention is nowhere near as great as it used to be in recent times. I calculate, based on the current rise in world foreign exchange reserves, that their gross buying of U.S. treasuries will be about $116 billion this year, which, you know, against an issuance of nearly a trillion, is pretty much chicken feed. So that has fallen away. Either says one of two things. One, they're giving up, or they're much less keen on determining an exchange rate. Or number two, simply their external accounts are pretty close to balance at the exchange rate they want. And if the private sector is effectively balancing the exchange rate where they want through a combination of a current account or capital account, then there is no intervention. So we can debate long run about reserve currency status of the dollar. But at the minute, there's not a lot of dollar accumulation going on from central banks. You know, I've made the case for a strong dollar, but it hasn't been based at all on the actions of central bankers. It's been based entirely on the actions of private savers, particularly the life insurance and pension funds of Japan and North Europe, who I think will see the dollar and dollar yields as attractive, but it's not based on foreign central bank. So there's one thing we can't really forecast, and that is that policy choice. You know, at any moment, any of the major central bankers of the world could announce a shift within the reserves. I don't think they could announce they were reducing the reserves unless they wanted to push their exchange rates up. But they could announce a shift in the reserve, and they could announce a shift away from the dollar. Now, that could happen, but it's very, very difficult to predict. Your readers should know that the IMF publish every quarter the composition of world reserves. So we can watch it every quarter, and, you know, there can be obfuscation even from official sources on the currencies that they hold. But we can watch it from quarter to quarter to see whether the percentage holding in United States dollars is falling. So we should get some warning if central bankers have decided to shift from one to the other. But I think the crucial thing about our future, and particularly for the U.S. Treasury market, is that the need to accumulate reserves is going down. And that means the need to buy treasuries is going down. And that just puts a huge pressure on private savers to fund the U.S. government. And that, I think, is really what's been going on really for the whole of this year. We're seeing a huge tectonic shift of higher yields dragging savings from other assets. Those assets have to be liquidated. That pushes the price down. And this is a movement which will be underway for many years. So the kind of big question you asked, will the dollar lose its reserve currency status? Unlikely to be in a time frame next 1 or 2 years that matters for any of us. But we are living in a world where the accumulation of dollar reserves by foreign central bankers has really slowed dramatically. And with the Fed liquidating its position in treasuries, then there's massive pressure on private sector savings to get into the treasury market. It's why another reason why I remain very cautious on all equity markets, on global growth, and particularly on assets outside the United States of America. So the world has changed because for the first time in 30 years, foreign central bankers are net sellers of treasuries. And that, I think, changes everything. But it does not, as yet, undermine the reserve currency status of the United States dollar.
Russell, one hypothesis that many people have posited is that as the dollar loses its reserve currency status, or even if it doesn't lose that status, if, just as you say, central banks are no longer feeling compelled to buy U.S. treasuries, that causes the U.S. to lose its so-called exorbitant privilege, the ability to fund its deficit spending without paying the penalty of much higher interest rates. And people have predicted that what's going to happen is the U.S. will be unable to continue its practice of borrowing and spending beyond its means, which it's grown accustomed to for a period of decades, because suddenly the bond market is going to insist that, yeah, deficits do matter again. Some people have gone on to even suggest that it could bring about a U.S. Treasury bond market, you know, crisis, an actual bear market that's a dramatic sell-off because people are panicking in this situation. How much of this is real and how much of this is conspiracy? Do we need to be concerned about the U.S. government being unable to fund itself because suddenly the bond market doesn't want to play ball anymore?
Yeah, well, that day might come, and really just referring back to the last question, if central bankers aren't buying treasuries, even though it remains the reserve currency. Part of the exorbitant privilege goes. I mean, they continue to own what they own. That clearly is part of an exorbitant privilege. But the real exorbitant bit of the privilege is when you force them to buy more. And that might be coming to an end. However, I'm certainly not in the camp that believes we're about to see a spike in treasury yields and a government struggling to fund itself. Because, of course, everybody in the planet is a saver relative to something else in the world. And as long as the Europeans hold down their yield curve, as long as the Japanese hold down their yield curve, then it creates an incentive for private capital, private savings to fund the United States government. There'd be much, much greater concern, I think, for the U.S. if we were looking at rapidly rising yields in Japan and Germany. If you like, then there's kind of a government's fighting for funding. But at this yield, not everybody agrees on this clearly because they do worry about inflation. But at this yield, I think real rates in America are very attractive. And the concern about spiking yields would be much more true if we were looking at rising yields in Germany and Japan and Northern Europe. But we're not yet doing that. So I don't have that concern. I've said it several times now in this call. I think that American government can really suck in savings from all over the world to fund itself at rates at or not far above where it is today. But this is the absolutely crucial point. Remember that the savings that have to be liquidated to fund the U.S. government can come from anywhere on the planet. They don't have to come from the United States of America. And therefore, funding what is now a $1 trillion deficit with a $228 billion Federal Reserve liquidation on top of that, I mean, it's a very, very big number. It's highly likely to be somewhat negative for U.S. equities, but it can come from all over the planet, and the impacts it can have outside of the U.S. are much bigger. So I wouldn't worry about that unless we see significant rises in European so-called risk-free rates and Japanese so-called risk-free rates.
Another trend that we're seeing is an apparent attack on the petrodollar system. Of course, the U.S. is no longer the biggest consumer of imported oil from the Middle East. And at the same time, we have, just this week, Nicolas Maduro offered to sell Venezuelan oil at a deep discount if the Indians would pay for it in his new cryptocurrency, bypassing U.S. dollars. We've seen Sergei Glazyev in Russia trying to pressure other countries to abandon the U.S. dollar for oil transactions. Is this trend towards moving a de-dollarization trend, if you will, away from the petrodollar system, a serious risk to the U.S. dollar's hegemony, and what consequences or implications does it have?
Yeah, it's a long-term trend, and clearly that's an issue, and clearly it will develop, and China will be absolutely key in this going forward, given that it's already the world's second biggest economy. You pointed out earlier that there are two reasons we use the reserve currency. One is for transactions, and then one is kind of, if you like, store of value, particularly by central bankers. We can see from your question that we are moving towards some new ways of doing these transactions. The question is, are we moving to a new way of a store of value? Or once we conduct that transaction, what do we hold the balance in? And will people be happy to hold these other balances? Will they be happy to hold Maduro's cryptocurrency? My answer to that is no, given the history of Venezuela in managing currencies, but maybe I'm wrong. But crucially, in terms of this whole thing, the real question is, will they be happy to hold the renminbi if we manage to create the renminbi petrodollar oil contracts? My answer to that, again, is on balance, no. They will not be happy to hold the balances that they accumulate in renminbi. Now, that relates effectively to the rule of law in China, and a fairly weak rule of law, and a rise in the rule of man relative to the rule of law. And I used to be a lawyer, so maybe I'm putting excessive weight on those legal rights that one gets in America, United Kingdom, or Europe, and one doesn't receive in China. But I think we're some way to go before people would be happy holding significant balances in either Maduro's currency or Xi Jinping's currency. But when that happens, of course, we're looking at a world where the dollar does not have to be held by a store of value, either by the central bankers or actually by the private sector. But at the minute, even private sector transactions, I can't imagine them ending up in RMB or Bitcoin currency as holdings, as stores of wealth. The dollar, as we all know, loses some value every year. That is the goal of the central bank, apparently, to make sure it loses some value every year. But ultimately, the rule of law and the right to protect your property is more important than that annual marginal depreciation they like to call inflation.
Now, of course, the gold bugs would tell you that the oil-selling countries are going to use this petro-yuan contract, which supposedly has a convertibility clause, although I'm not sure it really assures any conversion rate, where you could use your Chinese yuan proceeds from selling your oil to buy gold in the Shanghai Futures Exchange and take delivery of your gold. Do you think that there's a realistic chance of a trend developing where they're taking the gold and that potentially creates additional demand for gold and a bull market in gold bullion? Or is that more just the gold bug pipe dream that drives those kinds of speculation?
No, I think that's a more realistic way of looking at this. Gold is a recognized store of value. It's a volatile store of value, but over the long term, you know, we can show that it's a store of value. I think it's interesting, if that is the correct term in that contract, that the flow of capital into renminbi has an option to go back into gold, maybe suggesting to the people who've issued it in China that the contract may not work that well if people were forced to end up owning RMB balances, and that side strip into gold is important. So, look, if we were looking for something in the world that could be a store of value in this new world, then I would certainly put gold ahead of the renminbi. And for very obvious reasons, in terms of the title one has to gold compared to the title one has to the renminbi. So, it may well be a bull case for gold. I mean, I think gold will do exceedingly well over the long term. And, you know, define the long term as more than a couple of years. It's initially challenged by a world of a very strong dollar and rising interest rates. Rising real rates of interest and a strong dollar are somewhat of a challenge for gold. But we're moving into a world of much, much more government, much more of the word control and much less of the word price. And basically, we could do a nice chart on Google of the number of times the word control gets mentioned in the press and the number of times the word price gets mentioned in the press. And the more the word control goes up, the more the price of gold is going up. And that's a new structural normal. So any weakness in gold associated with a strong dollar is a buying opportunity. And those contracts you mentioned, they are a government action, a decided act by the government, which is going to make gold more attractive relative to paper currencies.
A final question on reserve currencies. I'll just open it to you. What other factors can you think of that are important for investors to consider or think about in this environment where maybe we're not moving from the dollar to a different reserve currency, but certainly the definition of reserve currency and what it means and the necessity of having just one of them is clearly changing? What else should investors be thinking about in this environment?
Yeah, absolutely. And what they should be thinking about is this is kind of a fake question. It may be that we're going to a new reserve currency. It may be the dollar's going down. And those are all possibilities. It is now a probability. It is now likely and probable that the pace of accumulation of reserve currencies itself has slowed dramatically or stopped. And if we shift the focus away from trying to second guess which central banker will be the first to liquidate the U.S. treasuries and focus more on the fact that that mechanism has stopped, then we focus on where in the near term, and I mean within the next couple of years, where the rubber hits the road. And the rubber hits the road in the U.S. Treasury market. These central bankers have bought, since 1991 until their peak ownership in 2014, they added $6 trillion U.S. dollars in treasuries to their holdings. That's foreign central bankers and the Fed. They're now liquidating. Had they not bought $6 trillion worth of U.S. treasuries, then the private sector would have had to buy $6 trillion worth of U.S. treasuries. Now, it's easy just to speculate on that must mean a higher yield in treasuries. Perhaps it does. But it's much easier to say that it means mass liquidation of private sector assets to fund the United States government. Now, that's a very different place you end up in if you ask a different question, which is not let's try and guess the geopolitics of reserve currency holdings and simply observe the fact that we are not getting central bankers buying in aggregate treasury securities. So my own view, as we've talked about during this interview, is that yields don't have to go much higher to push all those savings into the treasury market. But people should be looking at what will be liquidated in that process, or how high global savings rates will now have to go to generate the extra savings necessary to fund the government. The numbers are stark. Going back 3 years ago, the U.S. fiscal deficit was about $480 billion. It's looking at a trillion. It could easily be bigger than that. But when you add in the Fed's liquidation, we're going from $480 billion deficit to a total supply of treasuries to the marketplace of $1.3 trillion. And if central bankers, foreign central bankers, are buying very little, then that is what we need to focus on. So let's stop talking about the theoretical of what will not be a reserve currency long term. Interesting as it is and important as it is, and let's talk about the near term, is what happens in a world where central bankers stop buying treasuries.
Well, let's talk about that then. You wrote the book on bear markets. It sounds to me like you think there has to be a wholesale liquidation of some other asset in order to provide this treasury funding. I have to believe that other asset is stocks. So what do you see on the horizon in terms of what comes next for equity markets?
Yeah, it has to be portfolio assets. It has to be something that's liquid. Stocks are the one we think of, but corporate bonds are another one. And just to stress, it could be government bonds of countries other than the United States of America that currently have very low yields. So I'm negative on stocks because I see the liquidation, but I find it very difficult to point to a specific asset class that's going to be liquidated apart from emerging market equities, because it's the obvious one. Because the things that are going on in America, it's not, I mean, there's this liquidation going on, but these things that are happening in America, higher rates of interest, a stronger dollar, perhaps lower growth, perhaps not lower growth, really, really, really have the biggest impact on those countries that have borrowed dollars. So as we begin to see fundamental impacts, so we're saying real economy impacts, where will they be at the greatest? The real economy impacts would be greatest in emerging markets. But for the reasons I mentioned, I think it flow through into Europe. It would be easier to liquidate these equities, corporate bonds, that it would be to liquidate American equities and corporate bonds, because they're in the very firing line of a deteriorating fundamental position. And estimating the United States economy is much more difficult because of the scale of the fiscal stimulus. So yes, liquidation across the board of equities, but perhaps a U.S. equity market that outperforms even if it falls, because the real economic impacts could easily fall outside of America. When America sneezes, the world catches a cold. When the dollar goes up, the world catches pneumonia.
And what happens to junk bonds in this environment? It seems to me that would be the logical choice besides stocks. If suddenly treasuries are paying a worthwhile yield, who wants to own junk bonds anymore?
Yeah, so junk bonds would be a reflection of corporate cash flows. So I would put junk bonds and emerging market bonds together and say this. When we're worrying about future cash flows, you should be much more concerned about emerging markets than you should be about United States-issued junk bonds. That's where the real damage will be done. There would be a flow-through, of course, if emerging market bonds start going. I think we'll be looking at the world of credit with a more skeptical eye generally. And clearly, there are quite a lot of credits in America which are much lower quality than they have been in recent years. So absolutely, I wouldn't own junk bonds. But I think it'll be a kind of a slow grind for U.S. junk bonds in this scenario. But something pretty dramatic and quick can happen in emerging market bonds. So can this become a credit event in America of the scale of the last one? I think it's highly unlikely. You can still lose money in these investments, but I don't think it can be of that magnitude. But there are other places in the world where this absolutely can be of the magnitude that we saw in the United States. So the junk bond may look relatively good compared to emerging market debt, but it's absolutely not a place you're going to be making money. It's time to be incredibly cautious. I'm usually someone who recommends cash, which has been a bad recommendation for some time. But in this environment, cash becomes a rather good investment. We're watching and not really knowing what will be liquidated to sell the treasuries. So it's best to remain cautious in cash and wait to see where that liquidation process really begins to bite hardest. But my guess is where the economic impact is the greatest, and that will be emerging markets and not America.
Finally, Russell, we haven't talked about Japan yet. The yen has been falling. What do you see in terms of implications for what that means for the rest of the markets?
Yeah, so as you said earlier, as we discussed, the dollar is going up, and maybe it doesn't look that unusual, therefore, that the yen should be going down. However, something else is happening, a dramatic contrast between what's happening to the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve, shrinking from November 2017, to what is happening with the balance sheet of the Bank of Japan, which continues to grow apace, and I think will actually accelerate in its growth. We entered globally quantitative easing roughly at the same time. You know, you remember back, I think it was the Mexican finance minister who told us about the currency war that was coming. There wasn't much of a dislocation in currency markets because we were all doing quantitative easing at the same time. However, we are definitely not exiting quantitative easing at the same time. And the standout country, I think, that just can't stop quantitative easing is Japan. It's doing it, or we know why it's doing it. It's trying to generate money supply growth and economic growth and inflation, but it's also doing it because the saving system in Japan has been filled up with government debt. It runs a fiscal deficit to GDP ratio of 4%. In short, if the government wasn't if the central bank wasn't funding the government, it's difficult to see who would, particularly at reasonable interest rates commensurate with growth, the growth and inflation they want to deliver. So as time progresses, and the Fed, I think, will continue with its $228 billion treasury liquidation, $120 billion liquidation of other assets, as Japan goes the other way, then the yen will take the strain and people will begin to realize that Japan can't stop. That is very bullish for Japanese equities. It adds to the strength of the dollar, obviously. It creates issues for the renminbi as people look at a weak yen. A crucial part of the Asian economic crisis of 1997 was a very weak yen, and a very weak yen has negative implications for its neighbors and those who compete with it in trade, but it is positive for Japanese equities. So perhaps just, and this has been true now since November, perhaps just in the last few weeks, the market is beginning to focus on this thing that's changed. One country is hitting the brakes, and one country's foot is foot on the accelerator, as measured by the expansion of central bank balance sheets, and that ultimately has to feed through into the relative value of their exchange rates.
Russell, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. We're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time. You are one of my favorite authors. You just have a fantastic, prolific writing style. For the retail component of our audience, probably the best place to find that is going to be in your book, Anatomy of the Bear, which is an excellent analysis of all of the major bear market bottoms, how to identify them, how to look for buying opportunities at the bottom of bear markets. Unfortunately for the retail audience, your professional writings, which are actually free to registered and regulated professionals, are only available to that audience. Please tell us more about that for the professional component of our audience.
Yeah, well, apologies for that, but that is the world that we live in. And I run and own a website called Eric, and if you put my name and Eric into the Google, you will find it very quickly. It's where regulated providers of investment research and regulated fund managers can meet. We're changing the way research is consumed in the professional business, and that is no longer tagged or attached to commission quite the way it used to be. So I've set up this website. We've got really 130 research providers in there selling top-class, world-class research. So for professional investors, if you go in there, you get my – I write every fortnight, and I write for free for the professionals who come in there. And you can also have a look around and see if there's other research that fits your needs in this world of new research procurement rules, but I'm afraid it is professional investors only for that particular site.
And we've provided a link to that website in the Research Roundup email. Again, unfortunately, that is only for the regulated professionals in our audience, which makes up a little more than half of our audience, actually. Russell, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. We are going to need to leave it there. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Russell. Now, I agree in principle with his bigger picture themes and found it really interesting that he actually brought up Turkey a number of times. And I've been watching the Turkish lira a little bit. So I actually put together a chart book I wanted to speak to about all these emerging market currencies and what's going on. But before we get to that, I was first curious of what you took away from the interview.
You know, Patrick, I just love talking to Russell Napier. He's one of my favorite professionals in the entire financial industry. I've always enjoyed listening to his interviews with other interviewers, and I particularly enjoy interviewing him. I noticed that we got a really big reaction on Twitter as well when I tweeted and said that he would be our guest this week. So it's no surprise. He's really just an amazing guy. And I think it was very interesting, his view on inflation. And when you think about it, his view just about perfectly matches what Darius Dale from Hedgeye told us. And Hedgeye's been very right about this market as well, which is, hey, we've got oncoming signs of inflation, and it's likely to be reflected in terms of inflation showing up in the market. But I think Russell was basically echoing what Darius said. It's a head fake. It's not going to last by the end of the year. It's going to be over and done with. And to, you know, to hear that same exact view echoed by a couple of guests that both have excellent track records really got me to thinking about that. But I want to move on now, Patrick, because we've got a really great post-game chart book that you put together. Listeners, you'll find that in your Research Roundup email. I highly recommend that you go ahead and download it now, as we'll refer to it for the rest of the program. Patrick, what we've got here is really a couple of topics. The first one is an update on this S&P 500 correction and how it relates to previous market action. But then you put together an excellent book of charts that really take a deep dive into the U.S. dollar in more detail than we usually talk about it, comparing it to quite a few different currencies around the world. Let's start with the S&P 500 as we move into, I guess it's slide two here in your deck. Tell us what's going on with this picture.
When looking at chart number two, the one observation I really wanted to make was simply the fact that this has now been a very long market correction by the standards of what have been the past market corrections. We've noted that most market corrections were over within the 8-9 week kind of mark. We are pressing well into 12 weeks of this market correction since the January highs. And really, that kind of is a testament of how long this whole thing is taking. The question, of course, is if we don't make a lower low, then maybe that retest in April was, in fact, like a double bottom W kind of formation low. But, you know, the way the price action remains right now, it's very distributive in its nature. And just like you suggested in the pregame, we really have a chance that this S&P could still break to a fresh low. So that's really where I wanted to bring to chart three, where we discuss what I call the risk acceleration zone. And of course, that very important bottom level around that 2560 level, which we marked last week. What we saw after the Fed was a market that accelerated to the downside and actually even temporarily broke below the 2600 level. And it looked pretty scary earlier today, and we've recovered well off of that low, at least initially. But this continues to be an important line in the sand. The way I look at it here is that if we go into Friday and Monday, and this market, every rally just fails and brings it right back in there, it's going to be very hard to hold the line at 2600. And at that moment, if the S&P accelerates down to the previous lows near that kind of 2560 area, that's where a lot of more crazy things can happen in the S&P on the downside.
Well, and I want to ask you as a technician a question here, because obviously you and I have both expressed the opinion that even if there's another leg lower, let's say we go make a move down into the mid-2400s, what we've said in the past has been there's still plenty of room for that to end up still being just a correction and still retracing all the way back to new all-time highs. And as I look at this pattern developing, I kind of think, well, that made sense back before we got past that 8-9 week usual time frame. It seems to me at this point, you know, clearly one case is you get an upward break above this really what's become a descending triangle pattern here. Let's say above 2720. That pretty much says that the buy the dip moment is here and we're maybe headed back up. But if you do see at this point, this late in the game, this many weeks into it, a move down, let's say to 2450, at that point, do you still think that we're still in a correction and there's plenty of room to retrace back to all-time highs? Or do you think it's kind of game on at that point?
No, I think at this stage, my narrative still very much fits to what you were suggesting earlier, which is that even if we did have a break to a lower low, it's still likely to have a short-term low put in somewhere, probably exactly in that range. And a lot of the measured moves are measuring out about to the 2450 level on the S&P. I think that that will still be a temporary buy on dip. The markets have a very natural response mechanism. Once it gets oversold, that it has a deep mean reversion retracement that usually happens on the other side. And the only way that the selling in my mind is going to sustain is if by some chance that this is actually already a bear market. You know, bear markets have that characteristic of sustained distribution, you know, just the way if you look at a chart of like General Electric, right? They just keep selling and every rally is faded as the market is completely repricing risk. risk. Have we seen that? We can't rule it out. There's always a chance that that's happening. But at this stage, I think that the narrative that I would still put out there is that this is just going to be a deeper and longer market correction. We do a summer rally retrace back towards the highs. But if we go down to 2,400, I put a very low probability that we make a higher high into the summer. And, you know, I think that if we started at this kind of 2,600-2,700 level and we pole vaulted higher in a 2-3 month rally, we could arguably see an S&P that pokes its head above its previous high. But if we're starting off from 2,400 on the downside, the likelihood that we clear back to 2,800 or more into a summer rally becomes a less probable event. And so I think that we have to first see how the next couple of weeks play out, and then we can kind of speculate as to where the reaction moves will be. But I, at this stage, I'm not in the camp that thinks that this is a bear market already and this is just going to keep bleeding.
You know, I would agree with everything that you said, but just adding one caveat, which is if we get down there to 2,400, 2,450 in that range, and you also see a dramatic breakout past 3.05 on the 10-year, that starts to really concern me that maybe it's a full-on bear market at that point. But short of that, I agree there's plenty of room for there to be a bounce and a retrace. Maybe not all-time highs, but much higher than we are now. Let's move on, though, because I really want to get into to the dollar in more detail. Obviously, we've been talking a lot about the dollar in recent weeks. The dollar index, which is a measure of the dollar's value against a basket of currencies, primarily the euro, it's been rallying. The thing is, there's other currencies in the world. So let's look at the dollar relative first to the currencies that are in the dollar index basket, but let's also look at the currencies that are not in that basket, and let's see how the dollar's performance there compares. Let's start with page 5 here. Is you've got a chart of the dollar index, obviously very impressive looking breakout. Talk us through the first series of charts here, Patrick.
So first thing we want to start off with here is the dollar index. And the first thing that our listeners need to know is that the dollar index is composed of a weighting of 57% into the euro. And when you take the British pound and the yen into that weighting, it composes of 75% weighting into this index. So really, as go the three major currencies, goes the index. And so what we can observe as a starting point on this dollar index was that in mid-April, we saw that swing low, and then we saw a key breakout in late April that has now led to this several week market rally in the dollar index that has trading up to this 92.5 level.
Patrick, let's start by running through the three major currencies that are in the dollar index basket, which, as you just said, are the euro, the yen, and the pound sterling.
All right. Well, when we take a look on page 6 and we look at that euro, what's interesting is the euro already started to peak out in that 125 area as early as January and February. But what we really have seen was that the break on the downside really started in the middle of April. And as soon as we saw that breakdown, that's when the acceleration in the dollar index really began. As goes the euro, goes that dollar index. And so this arguably is that flag that has sent that big message that the dollar index is moving. When we go to chart 7 and 8, when we look at the pound and we look at the yen, what we can see is that the British pound broke that same type of ascending trend line after putting in a double top up near around 144. And at the same time, about the middle of April, we saw that retest of that high and a very nasty break on the downside of that pound sterling. In terms of the yen, that occurred at the early part of April, where we saw the low of the US dollar against the yen, and subsequently has already done a north of a 50% retrace of that entire drop that it had since January.
And of course, Patrick, for our listeners who may not be foreign exchange gurus, the reason that the chart of the yen looks different than the other charts is it's customary to do US dollar priced in yen as opposed to yen priced in dollar, because otherwise you'd be dealing with very small decimals. So it's almost an inverted shape of the chart. But what we are seeing when the line moves up here is that the dollar is actually appreciating as the value of the yen moves down. Let's move on to the other currencies that are in the US dollar basket, the less well-known ones. And while we're at it, let's also cover the Swedish krona, because although it's not in the basket, there's been a pretty big move there.
Absolutely. So we could actually talk to both the Swiss franc and the Swedish krona at the same time, because what's really interesting is they're obviously both linked to the euro quite a bit as European Union countries. And what we've seen is that they actually all bottomed back in February when we started seeing those peaks in the euro around 125. But what was particularly interesting about both currencies is that the US dollar has broken out meaningfully against both of these currencies already for the last 2 months. We've seen over 10% moves in the Swiss franc and the Swedish krona, which are on pages 9 and on pages 13. So moving on to the Canadian dollar, the Australian dollar, and the Kiwi, what's really interesting to observe is that the US dollar has bottomed against all three of those currencies somewhere in the third quarter of 2017. So we're going 6, 7, 8 months off the lows of each of those currencies. And the US dollar has been more or less strengthening for a better part of a half a year. And so we're seeing that the real break in the dollar index really didn't start with the euro. We've seen the breakdown in these currencies and the starting of the rise of the US dollar already, you know, for about 6 months in some of these different currencies.
Okay, so to summarize, what we're seeing in this series of charts is, even though it feels like the dollar index has only broken out of its consolidation range in the last few weeks, in reality, that's because the dollar index has such a heavy weighting against the euro and the yen and the pound. But as we look at the other currencies that make up the dollar index, the dollar had bottomed against those currencies months and months ago. Let's go ahead and carry this conversation forward to emerging markets and look at the BRICS currencies and see how those compare with the US dollar.
So Eric, when we're looking at the BRICS, I wanted to start off by looking at pages 15, 16, and 17, which was the Brazilian real, the Russian ruble, and the Indian rupee. And what we as well see here is that the US dollar has just been ripping higher against all of these currencies pretty much since the start of the year. In the cases of the Brazilian real, we saw it's very similar characteristics to the Canadian dollar, where the lows of the US dollar came in around September, and we've seen a 10 to 15% move in that currency. Obviously, the Russian ruble being impacted by the sanctions, which really made the big break of the trend line that we have drawn on there. And of course, a similar trend line on the Indian rupee, which when it broke that 64.5 level, it just ripped up towards 67 on the upside very, very quickly. It's actually only the Chinese currency that has not really accelerated. And of course, that's because it trades against a basket of currencies, which are obviously on a trade-weighted basis is heavily into the euro and other things like that. But really, that's where looking at that Hong Kong dollar, which we talked about over the last couple of weeks, is very relevant. Because even after things cooled off the other week, we find ourselves on that Hong Kong dollar once again trading near the 785 level.
Well, Patrick, it seems that there's a very interesting pattern here, because I think back to our conversations, both my own views on the dollar as well as a lot of expert guests that we've interviewed in the program. And in that time frame, around the end of 2017, just the last couple months of 17 into the beginning of 2018, a lot of people, myself included, were expressing the opinion that, hey, we think the dollar should be bottoming here and start to move higher. And we were proven wrong. Let's be clear about that. But we were proven wrong with reference to the dollar index. If we look at the dollar versus quite a few of the different currency pairs around the world, especially in the more developed markets, we're really seeing that that prognosis of the dollar bottoming towards the end of 2017 really was proven true in quite a few markets. But let's go into the truly emerging markets now and talk about the Mexican peso, the Turkish lira, and the Argentine peso.
So starting on chart number 22, I have a chart here of the US dollar as it's trading against the Mexican peso. And what we again see is a scenario where the US dollar seemed to have been putting in its bottom again in that September window of 2017. And even though it kind of retested it, it looks like the US dollar is about to break out against that Mexican peso to the upside. But really where the interesting story is when we go to the Turkish lira, which obviously Russell Napier referenced a couple times throughout the interview. And what's particularly interesting is that we're really seeing a currency crisis emerging in the Turkish lira as the U.S. dollar continues to rip higher aggressively against the currency. There's all sorts of stresses that are occurring there. Obviously, they're trying to repatriate their gold, and we've seen them numerous times comment about how they don't like the existing currency system and the fact that they're bound to the U.S. dollar system. And we're really seeing the stress cracks there. And when you look at that, and you look as well as the Argentinian peso, which just right now had to, in a surprise rate hike, lift rates to a staggering 33.25% in the second surprise rate hike. They essentially are continuing to see a huge currency crisis. And, you know, when we hear a number of these analysts starting to suggest that we're on the verge of a financial accident likely to occur outside of the U.S., you're really seeing some stress points here that could really escalate. And it'll be very interesting to see, you know, whether or not this reversal in the dollar index that we're seeing is just the beginning of a bigger move of with all of these different currency stresses happening around the world.
Well, Patrick, I can't wait to get Juliette de Klerk back on the program because in spite of all of this, she's on top of all of these markets, I assure you. She still thinks that what we're seeing in the dollar in terms of the strength of the dollar is temporary. And I'm very curious to ask Juliette when we get her on the program whether that view is only specific to specific currencies like the yen and the euro, or if she sees a reversal of this trend of the dollar strengthening against so many of these other currencies around the world. We do have Juliette scheduled in a couple of weeks in the program. Next week, we've got Charles Gav. We've got Juliette de Klerk the week after that. And we continue to do the best that we can in order to bring you the very best feature interview guests. We sure appreciate it, folks, if you do the best you can to help us promote Macro Voices. So please tell your friends, family, colleagues, and so forth about Macro Voices. Forward your research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues. And most importantly, if you haven't done so already, shame on you. Go to macrovoices.com and register your free account. It only takes a minute. It's free. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compilation of links to the very best research that we can find on the internet, as well as downloads of presentations from our feature interview guests. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview. You'll also find the link to the chart book that Eric and I discussed in the post game. I also have a link to an article from Russell Napier on the Fed's ammunition just ran out. There's also a link to a number of articles that elaborate on the what is happening with that Argentinian peso as well as the Turkish lira. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Sresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening. And we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.